This is Robert Beatty bringing you London Column. London Column, which brings you items especially chosen for your interest and entertainment from the worldwide service of the BBC. In this edition of London Column, Captain Nichols of Louisville, Kentucky, describes in detail a rapid advance by armored forces. BBC war correspondent Dennis Johnson tells you what happens when the Allies take over a German town. And Audrey Russell takes you from a control post to the scene of a B-bomb incident where you hear Britain's civil defense workers on the job. To most of us, a report of a rapid advance by armor is thrilling and exciting news. We feel it brings the end nearer, and we hasten to draw arrows in our maps. But few of us know how an armored advance is carried out. We now bring you a conversation recorded on the Western Front between Captain Nichols from Louisville, Kentucky, now serving with the 10th Armored Division, U.S. Army, and BBC war correspondent Robert Reed.
Now then, Captain, tell me, how does an armored division go so fast, and what's it like to be with it?
Well, the main objective of armor is to smash its way either through or around the flank of the enemy and completely disrupt his lines of communication and supply, and also to take certain objectives which are absolutely necessary to enable a division to keep on rolling forward. Speed and surprise counts the whole time, and the whole essence of the business is smashing through everything. For instance, in the recent drive through the Sarmazel Triangle, our first objective, the town of Thorn, was captured in exactly 40 minutes. And then we rolled on, and in the next 2.5 days, cleared the entire triangle of all enemy opposition.
But when you're spearheading in this way, right into the enemy lines, doesn't it make you feel that you're rather sticking out your neck?
Oh, that's absolutely right. But we always hope that the element of surprise is going to work in our favor, and that we're going to break right through and grab our objective before the Jerrys wake up and realize just what's going on. But, of course, there are many gambles you simply must take.
Such as,
for one thing, we usually get a great deal of sniper fire all around us. We run into many minefields, and the boys in the tanks have plenty of guts to blast down the road when they don't know whether the road is mined or not. And then on top of that, there are also Jerrys well hidden with bazookas and anti-tank guns ready to bang away at our task force as soon as it pokes its nose around the corner. It causes a hell of a lot of trouble, and they're difficult to flush out of their positions. But this sort of thing is all part of the gamble an armored division must take.
Now, one other thing. In a running battle like this, where you're obviously getting well away from the jump-off point, how are the operations directed?
Well, the answer to that is the command post of a division like ours follows closely behind the attacking forces. And as these forces continue to advance, the operational command post moves up at the same time. It's a highly mobile outfit which can pack up and move on in 5 minutes, and is subject to the same shelling that the tanks up ahead are receiving, and sometimes more.
And what about supplies of gas and ammunition and food when you're making a thrust like this and you're already miles away from the starting point and the supply areas?
We have, of course, our own supply units who oftentimes have to run a gauntlet of fire in order to reach the boys who are up there pitching with everything they've got. And I want to say that these supply trains are doing a wonderful job, which is so often overlooked when the credits for winning a battle are being given out.
That conversation on the rapid advance of armor was recorded in Western Europe by BBC war correspondent Robert Reed and Captain Nichols of the 10th Armored Division. When a German town is captured following the armored thrust and occupation by the infantry, the Allied military governor moves in to take charge. Another BBC war correspondent, Dennis Johnson, went into the city of Bonn with the Allied military governor, and he describes now what happened.
We found our way to the Rathaus, the town hall, through a tangle of overhead tramway wires. And in here, Major Margolis, the regimental military governor, had already gathered together 6 or 7 of the remaining city officials. They were all of them secondary officials and assistants. The really big shots, the Oberbürgermeister, the postmaster, and the chief of police had gone. but the ones that remained seemed quite prepared to cooperate. And after Major Margolis had introduced them to Major Copran, the deputy of the divisional governor, he rapidly ran them through a score of vital questions. How many doctors were left in town? How many chemists? How many displaced persons? What had happened to the Allied prisoners in the Stalag? How many days' food was there in stock? Swiftly, the answers came. Only about 4 chemists. There were about 52,000 civilians left out of a normal population of about 105,000. There were about 2,000 displaced persons and Allied nationals, mainly scattered in outlying farms. The prisoners of war had been removed across the Rhine. There was no electricity or gas, but there was running water, and the telephone system was in working order. 4 out of 20 elementary schools were still functioning, and they had food for about 30 days. But the bread situation looked serious, as the principal bakery was on the far side of the river and in enemy hands. Then Colonel Lancer and Major Copran briefly outlined to these German officials the principles on which the Allied military government would act. The administration, they said, would be fair, just, and businesslike. Every official would be expected for the present to remain at his post and maintain the civil administration as far as possible. But no prominent or ardent Nazi would be employed. It would be the responsibility of the Germans to feed themselves and also to feed, clothe, and house the displaced persons. But they wouldn't be expected to contribute towards the feeding of the American forces. All former members of the Wehrmacht were to turn themselves in at once. All discriminatory laws against the Jews were abrogated, and they were no longer to be forced to wear any kind of distinguishing mark on their clothing. The officials listened to each point without any comment, other than a grave nod of the head. They seemed to know how to take orders.
That account of the occupation of the German city of Bonn came from BBC war correspondent Dennis Johnson. Southern England is still under attack from the Nazis. Their V-bombs fall, and when they fall in built-up areas, they naturally cause casualties and damage. A BBC reporter, Audrey Russell, was talking to an ambulance driver in a civil defense post when there was an explosion nearby. She had her microphone with her and recorded everything that happened. Here is her report of how Britain's civil defense army goes to work.
While she was speaking, there was an explosion in the distance. It didn't occur to me that it was in our district, but the telephone girls sprang into action. We brought the microphone at once into the control room, and we recorded this.
Hello, no, bus service? Near, I should think.
Yes, from that bus bank?
No information.
Please don't know.
You think it's near North Road?
Bus service.
Control service.
I think it's near North Road.
Ah, well, here's the warden's message.
24. Yes. North Road, junction Winton Road. Fire? Yes, casualties? Yes, trapped. Right. North Road Junction, Winton Road.
I see North Road Junction, Winton.
Yes, direct hit on houses.
Okay. North?
Later on, we followed the services down to the incident. I think it can be best described by this recording, which I made on the spot.
Well, we've come down to the junction of North Road and Winton Road to the incident that we heard reported in control just a short time ago. It's a pretty sad sight because the V-bomb has fallen smack in the middle of a row of little residential houses. They're two-story houses. The houses' offices are blasted out, and I can see in front of me a few people trying to salvage little bits and pieces of furniture that they think they can get away. In the center of the damage, the rescue parties are already working hard. Just near me here, there is a rescue party working particularly hard because I believe that they've been told that a mother and baby are buried underneath. There are two big cranes working to lift the heavy debris. Maybe you can hear them as I speak. I can see several people that I recognize that I spoke to this morning. And a little further down the road are the WVS Inquiry Center, where there's a long queue of, I suppose, friends and relatives making inquiries. They look very dazed and shocked. But I suppose they lived somewhere nearby. I have beside me the incident officer, Mr. Blackman, whom I spoke to just now. Can you tell me, Mr. Blackman, how's the work getting on?
Oh, not too bad now at all. It seemed to get on the way. As you see, the type of property, the chances of getting casualties out very quickly is rather remote. There's so much stuff to move. Yes. But we are now looking for 6. And out of that 6, I'm hoping, please God, that 2 of those will eventually turn up with our usual inquiry.
Oh, my goodness, there's a...
part of this house falling down. Are they pulling it down by the crane?
Yes. Oh, yes, they're pulling that down because it was a dangerous structure for the men working underneath, you see.
Yes, I see. The dust now, as we speak, is absolutely terrific. I don't wonder that these men can only work at a maximum rate of 4 hours. It's just like a thick fog right in the center of the damage. Can you tell me, Mr. Blackman, do you think you'll be able to finish this job up and get these people out before it gets dark?
Well, I most certainly hope so. There is that possibility, but we have made arrangements to work through the night, and that is contemporary lighting and searchlights, etc. here. But I do visualize that we possibly will have to work through the night because there's such a lot to move.
I watched them for some time, methodically getting on with the work. Slowly but surely, they restored order in the chaos of those shattered homes. It was 15 hours after the bomb fell that a telephone girl back in control room sent out this message.
Yes. Hello? Incident, North Road, Junction, Winton Road. Closed. Yes. Casualties all accounted for? Yes. Yes. Services returned to depot? Yes. Yes. Inquiry point open until tomorrow. Okay?
Yes, yes, this is fine.
Bye-bye. Thank you.
That is a story of civil defense. It's a tale of individual effort and performance, an account of superb organization by just a few of Britain's civilian army, civil defense.
That V-bomb incident was reported to you by BBC war reporter Audrey Russell. As from London, we witness the climax of this long war. We look forward to the day when London's silence will be unbroken by sirens and explosions. Into that new peace, many sounds nearer to our hearts will be heard. Among them, the sound of the bell to one of our oldest London churches, the Church of St. Mary Le Bow. And to the sound of their music, this is your narrator, Robert Beatty, closing London Column. The program was written and produced by John Irwin.